You have aligned to Congressman Mark Pocan on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're headed to Capitol Hill to check in on a range of issues before Congress, including President Trump's plan to send undocumented immigrants to so-called sanctuary cities. The president tweeted about it last weekend, saying he has the legal right to send migrants to areas where local authorities refuse to help federal officials in enforcing immigration laws. And so Milwaukee County, Madison, Racine have all been generally recognized as sanctuary places in the state. What questions do you have for the congressman? How do you want him to vote on immigration legislation? Mark Pocan is a Democratic U.S. representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, which includes Madison, Beloit, and Dodgeville. Congressman Pocan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thanks, Kate. Glad to be here.
Well, before we get to immigration, let's start with the Mueller report. The Justice Department said that Attorney General William Barr will release Robert Mueller's report to Congress tomorrow morning sometime. What are you hoping will come out of this nearly 400-page redacted report?
Well, I hope that they redact it as narrowly and as necessarily as possible. I think the American people and Congress deserve to see the full report. So far, we've seen 65 words out of the 400 pages. So clearly, there's a lot more that we need to see. But I hope that they really give us the full extent of what the report was, because I think it's the best way for the American people to really be able to make their own decisions about what happened when the Russians tried to interfere in our elections.
And you have said that, quote, the American people deserve the full truth behind the special counsel's report, and any attempt to censor it will be unacceptable. Does that mean that if the report seems heavily redacted to you, that you would fight it in some way?
Oh, no question. I recently did an open records request on the 83 arrests last September by ICE, and after 138 days of waiting for a response, I got 297 pages out of 400 redacted. I mean, clearly, you know, that sort of thing is not acceptable. I don't think we'll get anywhere close to that on the Mueller report, but, you know, we really have to be very careful that we're only redacting things that are of real national security needs, and there's a few other qualifiers. But really, most everything else should be in the public domain, and I hope that they take that spirit to the report, and then I look forward to reading it, as I think everyone in the country does.
Right, so as this comes into the public domain, what is the next move for Democrats here?
Well, I think it's really to see what all happened. I mean, let's remember what this is about: Russians interfering with our elections. We want to make sure that no country or individual, for that matter, can ever do that again. So this should be a good learning experience. But if it turns out along the way people were doing anything to obstruct justice or anything else, we also need to know that. So I think that's why the report was done. Clearly, it's been one of the most successful reports of its kind we've had. There were, I think, somewhere in the mid-30s, number of people that were indicted, several hundred federal crimes. And you think back to the Benghazi investigation that went 4 years and there were zero indictments. I mean, this is a real, a very active report that did a good job of getting to criminal activity. This should be seen by everyone who wants to see it.
We're talking with Mark Pocan, Democratic U.S. Representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District. You have a line at 800-642-1234. What question do you have for Congressman Pocan? How do you want him to vote on immigration legislation? What actions do you want out of House Democrats regarding the federal budget? Call in at or email ideas at WPR.org. Congressman, President Trump has said that immigrants without authorization to be here in the U.S. will be diverted to these so-called sanctuary cities, which are cities that say they won't assist in immigration enforcement or deportation. Is this something you expect the president will follow through on?
This idea is so incredibly silly and stupid. I would expect it from, I don't know if you remember the old Beavis and Butthead cartoon, the adolescent underachievers who'd come up with something like this, not from the president and Stephen Miller. If you're really trying to stop people from coming across the border, you don't offer them across the country transportation, which is what essentially this idea is. It makes no sense whatsoever. We've had bad idea after bad idea when it comes to the border with this White House, and it's really getting to a breaking point. I mean, if you want to stop people from coming from countries that have horrific conditions, we've got to help improve those conditions. If we want to stop drugs from coming into this country, we know 90% come through legal ports of entry, not across the southern border, then beef up the activity at the legal points of entry. But building a wall or giving people bus tickets across the country, why don't we just give them a bank account? You know, maybe that would really convince them not to come. It just falls in the idea of cartoon world and not serious proposal.
So how do we improve conditions on the southern border and at these legal ports of entry? What do you do?
Well, one is you go back to some of the ways we used to do with this. Instead of detaining every single person, which is very, very expensive, and we had rates of 95% plus showing up to their legal proceedings previously because they're claiming asylum, because they're trying to escape violence. They want to be a part of this country. That worked well, and it was much less expensive. I mean, what we really need to do is have comprehensive immigration reform. With this president, that may be difficult, but doesn't mean we shouldn't be trying. But doing what we're doing now, separating kids from their parents at the border, I think we're about to go back to that by watching what's happening right now with the president and some of the actions and getting rid of the Homeland Security Secretary, withdrawing his nomination to be the head of ICE. You know, we're going back to all these acting directors. So once again, Donald Trump is really the director of all these areas. And he's the one who's had a lot of these ideas that, you know, let's just say generously they're bad ideas. Well, and they're not accomplishing the very goals that he claims we need to protect the border, which is the human trafficking and the drugs and the gang activity. None of those address that.
Well, let's look, though, at what Congress is doing to this extent. On Twitter, the president said, quote, "Congress must fix the laws and loopholes he sees as forcing the release of illegal immigrants." How can Congress get on the same page?
Well, again, you know, if you have a 95% plus success rate, that wasn't broken. When you have children who've been here, like in the DACA program, since maybe they were 2 weeks or 2 months old, and they may not know the country they originally were born in or speak the language of that country, shipping them back, that's something he broke. So many of the ideas that he's put forward are his own problems that he's created. And we need to do, again, is have, when I first sessioned in Congress, four sessions ago, we had a bipartisan bill come out of the Senate with nearly 70 votes that was comprehensive immigration reform. It had a pathway to citizenship for aspiring Americans. We've got about 13 million people here who are undocumented, and it had some protections at the borders. We need to go back to that rather than the way this president has addressed the border.
Let's take a moment here and look at ICE. In February, you stood outside the headquarters of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, distributing what looked like missing posters that asked if people had seen a request you submitted for information about raids conducted here in Wisconsin. What was going on there? What came of that?
Yeah, you know, it's odd. Generally, when I was in state government for 14 years, or now 6-plus years here in the federal government, when you have a request of an agency, they're very willing to give you information because you are an elected lawmaker and you're in charge of their budgets and all sorts of things like that. This is my first Freedom of Information Act request I've had to do in 6 years in Congress was to ICE when they arrested 83 people in Wisconsin. They refused to tell my local law enforcement in South Central Wisconsin or my local elected officials anything about the raids. In fact, in Dane County, for 6 weeks, they communicated with other counties and they refused to contact our local law enforcement. And, you know, when you do something like that, you have to engage local law enforcement so they know what's going on. But they won't tell us what the arrests were for. They told us it was a list of 250 people that committed crimes. Well, we couldn't get any answers, so I did a Freedom of Information Act request. They refused to provide answers to that. And I finally had to stand outside the headquarters and hand out missing posters. And we found out why, because about 40 to 50% of those people had no crimes whatsoever, and very few people had the type of crimes that they told us they were going after.
Pausing right there, talking with Congressman Mark Pocan about pressing issues on Capitol Hill. You have a line, 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's a conversation with Congressman Mark Pocan on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. House Democrats' new left liberals have swelled the ranks of the Congressional Progressive Caucus to close to 100 members, and Representative Pocan is co-chair. We saw the influence of this caucus recently when House Democratic leaders scrapped plans to vote on a two-year budget blueprint that would have increased both military spending and domestic spending. What questions do you have for Congressman Pocan? How do you want him to vote on a 2020 spending bill? You can call in 800-642-1234, tweet us WPR Mornings. Let's go to the phones now with Gary joining us from Iron River. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, good morning, folks. The comment I want to make about this whole argument of the fence is it seems like the arguments have just become silly. When do we ever see gates without fences, whether it's around a farmer's field, whether it's an entry to an amusement park? You got to have something to force people to the gate. We don't see the amusement park people have a gate and then have a whole line of people to protect the perimeter and force people there. It just seems like such a basic common sense idea that the political arguments have made it impossible for people to think rationally about.
So Gary finds that we're just not thinking rationally about the border wall. Congressman?
Yeah, so to Gary's point, about a quarter of the border, maybe it's a slightly less than that, does already have some type of fencing where the more populated areas are, where they need to have it. But this is 2,000 miles of largely completely empty land that makes no sense to build a very, very expensive border wall when you could have drones doing observation. You could have so many other modern ways of doing technology that don't require a medieval solution, which is a wall, that you could do that for a fraction of the cost and still have all the security. And we know that 90% of all the drugs that enter this country come through legal entry points. So let's beef up the protections there. There are better, smarter alternatives to doing this, and I think that's what we're really trying to propose.
Gary, thanks for the call. Congressman, let's look at the Progressive Caucus, which you co-chair. There's been some infighting among House Democrats over budget caps recently. The Progressive Caucus wants just as much money to be spent on domestic programs as defense. What can you tell us there, and why does the caucus want to see this change?
Yes, first of all, I think it's a largely overblown inside the Beltway story on that. So just because the way it normally is done, things are not necessarily done these days up front. They're done as we do the final negotiations in September, and we can change things anywhere along the way. So this was a bit of a, reporters in D.C. looking to find some controversy story. But to the broader point, this nation needs to seriously invest in our infrastructure. We need to make sure that everyone who needs access to health care has access to health care. And those things are the non-defense spending areas of the government. Just in infrastructure alone, our nation's infrastructure has been given a D-plus grade by the American Society of Civil Engineers, and one out of every six bridges is old enough to be eligible for Medicare, just to make it a visual. So we need to invest in those sorts of things, and we wanted to make sure that the non-defense spending was increased as it used to be to the defense spending levels, so that we actually prioritize things like education, healthcare, and infrastructure rather than just increasing the defense side. So really, it's investing in what we need to really support the vast majority of Americans. And, for too long, that's been neglected, and we really need to start getting focused on that. And that tax bill, people just saw, they paid their taxes the other day. They were promised, the average family was promised a $4,000 pay increase because of that tax bill. Not only did people not get the pay increase, they also didn't get the refund. And at the end of the day, that added $1.9 trillion to the nation's deficit. Those are the sort of things we have to address, not cutting back on spending money on bridges that are 60 or 70 years old.
Well, getting back to the Progressive Caucus for a moment, you've seen your ranks growing, especially as newcomers come into the House. Do you find that Democrats are on the same page with the vision that the Progressive Caucus wants to lay out?
Well, I think we've been incredibly unified, especially the first 100 days. We ran on three big areas in November, cleaning up the corruption in Washington, dealing with health care and the cost of prescription drugs, and dealing with infrastructure and raising people's wages. We've already passed our first bill we passed, H.R. 1, was a bill that was a comprehensive election, campaign finance, and ethics reform bill. Every single Democrat voted for it, and every single Democrat was a sponsor. We've passed two bills on gun violence prevention. We've passed a bill on paycheck equity for women who are making 80 cents on the dollar to men. We've addressed the crisis in Yemen, although just last night the president vetoed that bill. We're going to have to revisit that when we come back. But we've done all sorts of things, and in the works is a minimum wage increase, is some infrastructure spending, is more bills to address the cost of prescription drugs. We're all doing this in unison. So I think what's really interesting is after the last 2 years, Congress really doing nothing but passing a tax break where 83% of the benefit in a decade goes to the top 1%. We've been actually doing the things that we promised voters we'd do, and we're doing it hand in hand. So I think those are all good progressive ideas, and I'm really proud that the Democrats are moving forward together on these efforts.
One of the policies you've said the caucus will promote is Medicare for all. Where do you see that going for your caucus, and will it get traction?
Yes, I'll tell you, I'm starting my town halls today. I've got two in Darlington and Monroe this week, and then we've got four more next week while I'm home. One of the things that comes up at every town hall, and usually someone comes up afterwards, is they're afraid they're going to lose access to their health care. We've got people afraid that if we lose the protections that came with the Affordable Care Act for pre-existing conditions, that their child may not have health insurance. This is like a real kitchen table economic core issue to most families. The problem is there's been death by a thousand cuts to the Affordable Care Act. We need to shore it up, and you're not finding the president or the Republican Senate willing to do that. I think America is just tired of all these different solutions that still don't give health care, and they look at countries like Canada and most of Europe where people have it as a right, and Medicare for All would do just that. Medicare is one of the most popular programs, the programs that the federal government has, and it's an idea that we don't have enough votes to pass it yet, but we are definitely in the period where we're trying to educate people and educate lawmakers about why Americans are desperate to have health care coverage for their families.
Let's go to Steve now, joining us from Sun Prairie with thoughts. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Hey, you know, one of the things that the story about the whole Russian collusion thing that really came out that's been made public is that the Russians really were attempting to cause divisiveness within our populace. They were sending out emails that were for Black Lives Matter and others against Black Lives Matter. That was really their intent. One of the things that Democrats have been doing for the past 10 years has been to really promote that idea using identity politics. My question is, what is Mark doing specifically to stop the Democrats from using identity politics, which is causing divisiveness, which is exactly what the Russians want?
Congressman Pocan?
Yes, Steve, I guess I disagree with some of your premise. I agree with you on, you're right, that was one of the tactics the Russians used. Also, we know the Russians said their intent was to elect Donald Trump. That's not a question. So I think that issue is a little different than your other issue. First of all, I don't think we use identity politics. We are a big tent as Democrats. We do have a very diverse membership that represent the party. Therefore, you're going to have a lot of diverse voices, and we understand that. We don't have to agree with each other on every single issue, but we do have to move forward together on important issues like health care and climate change and investing in our infrastructure and raising people's wages. Those are things that we do have to work together on, and that's why I think every bill I just told you that we passed in the first 100 days addressed those issues, and nothing really addressed what you just said the problem was, which is identity politics. So I think often Fox News and Republicans want you to think that's what we're only talking about, but the proof is in the bills that we've actually passed this session, and that's anything but that.
We had a caller who couldn't stay with us, wanted to know how you're approaching the current dairy situation in Wisconsin. Dairy farmers are struggling, farms are going dark. How are you working to tackle this problem?
Yeah, that is a great question, a big concern. My district obviously has a lot of dairy. Prices are about as low as they've been, and that's causing a lot of problems. But the real problem we're facing right now is the president not having a coherent trade policy. Because of his fights with China and over NAFTA with Canada and Mexico, there have been a lot of tariffs that have been thrown back and forth, often by us, then getting retaliatory tariffs. And some of that has caused a real additional squeeze on dairy farmers and also soy farmers and others, soybean farmers in the district. So this is something that, one, we have to get the president to a coherent trade policy, because we don't need self-inflicted wounds for already a depressed pricing structure for dairy. And two, I think we need to do everything we can to help keep family farms. We've been fortunate in Wisconsin compared to other states. We still have a lot of family farms, but we lost over 500 last year alone, and we've got to do something to support that, and I think we need to have a lot more efforts focused on that rather than trade wars that give us tariffs that make it harder to sell overseas.
Congressman Pocan, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Kate. I really appreciate it.
Mark Pocan is a Democratic U.S. representative from Wisconsin's 2nd Congressional District, including Madison, Beloit, and Dodgeville. Coming up, the Secretary-designee of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development joins us to talk about his priorities for workers and employers in the state and overcoming the challenges that both groups face. That's after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're going inside the Evers administration to discuss how the state is attracting workers, trying to raise the minimum wage, and finding openings for job growth. It's a conversation with the Workforce Development Secretary. Workers, what are your big concerns? What are the barriers to employment in Wisconsin that you see? And business owners, are you having issues finding employees? What would help you? What role should state government play in all of this? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Caleb Frostman is the Secretary-designee of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. Secretary Frostman, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me, Kate. I'm excited to be here.
Well, Governor Evers signed an executive order this week that will make it easier for the state to take action against employers who misclassify their workers. Companies sometimes classify workers as independent contractors when they're really employees. Is this a big issue in Wisconsin?
It is, and it creates an uncompetitive landscape. So the folks that follow the rules and classify their workers as employees as they're supposed to, they're at a disadvantage when people don't pay into the system, and they're able to pay their folks less, and they're able to pay less in taxes. And so it's really important that we have a level playing field, and that people who follow the rules have a competitive advantage. And so we're really cognizant of making sure that we're protecting all of our state's interests, our workers, and our employers as well.
Has this issue just cropped up recently, or has this been a long problem in Wisconsin?
This has been a longstanding problem, and it's Wisconsin's not unique. It's a nationwide issue, and so we're trying to be strategic and send a message that we're going to make sure that we enforce misclassification in Wisconsin and be very proactive about it going forward.
What role does your department have in this effort to make sure companies are classifying their workers correctly?
So a lot of our divisions are impacted by misclassification, whether it's unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, equal rights has also been involved. And so we've got a pretty strong stake in what happens is that we have really highly trained investigators when it comes to all sorts of things, including former law enforcement officials, to make sure, former white-collar investigators that can look into these things and be informed and understand the nuances of misclassification and help us recoup some of these dollars that, are being illegally not paid into the system.
Do you think it'll take more than an executive order to solve this problem?
Well, I think that's part of the task force between the Departments of Justice and Revenue, the Office of Commissioner of Insurance, myself. So it's going to be a full court press. And I think a lot of private employers are interested in this, too, because they're playing by the rules and perhaps losing out on bids due to cost because folks aren't playing by the rules. So there's strong buy-in throughout both the public and private sector to see this change.
Foxconn has received $4.5 billion in incentives to build their factory in southeast Wisconsin. And last summer, you said you didn't support incentives that large. What do you do now as head of workforce development, now that Foxconn is a done deal?
Yeah, it's a great question. So similar to the governor, I think that the tax incentive, and I'm pretty cognizant of this when I talk to folks, that there's a difference between the tax incentive package that was used to bring Foxconn here and what Foxconn is trying to do. And so, similar to the governor, I don't think that the tax incentive package to bring them here was a good deal for taxpayers. But the Foxconn deal is law. And so we are ready, willing, and able to help Foxconn with their workforce needs as they move forward, whether that's with upskilling or finding new workers. And we are ready to help them out. I was in Racine and Kenosha last week talking to stakeholders in that area, the county exec, Racine County Economic Development, about all sorts of stuff happening in Southeast Wisconsin, but also including Foxconn. So we've got resources at the ready. And so I think as Foxconn's ideas kind of crystallize as to what's going to happen down there. It sounds like there is some new clarity with their announcement a couple weeks ago. We stand ready to help them and are looking forward to doing so.
Do you feel the state has enough clarity to know what Foxconn is needing and wanting and doing and what their workforce needs really are?
I think we're getting there. I think the announcement a couple weeks ago of the 1,500 employees in that part of the state is a step in the right direction just in terms of kind of further clarifying what's going to be happening down there. And I know they haven't backed down from their $13,000 commitment, but in the near term, that 1,500 is a step in the right direction. There's been some ambiguity about what was going to happen, but I think that's an encouraging step going forward, at least kind of figuring out what we can help plan for at the state level and on the private sector as well.
So what role do you see Foxconn having in Wisconsin's economy when it gets up and running?
They could be, just like a lot of other successful Wisconsin manufacturers, they could be a large supply or large employer in the southeast part of the state. I think there is interest and I think optimism in having a supply chain pipeline in Wisconsin. Now, as those plans, at least in the near term, have been scaled down a bit, we'll kind of see what that looks like. But I think there's opportunity and there's potential for that to be a catalyst for some things down there. And I know a lot of private development is in the works as a result of the initial Foxconn announcement. And I don't see that necessarily diminishing with these initially scaled back plans. So there's opportunity. There's a lot of big Wisconsin manufacturers that are either existing or expanding. But I think Foxconn coming here at potentially 1,500 employees out of the gate could have an impact throughout Wisconsin.
We're talking with Caleb Frostman. He is Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. And you have a line at 800-642-1234. What workforce issues do you want to bring to the fold here? What do you want to ask him in terms of how your business is doing and how it could continue to thrive or perhaps change in some way? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. The latest data shows Wisconsin's unemployment rate is at 2.9%. That's close to the record low of 2.8% that we reached in April of last year. Is a low unemployment rate a sign that things are going really well for Wisconsin's economy, or is there more nuance?
That's a really good question. Something I talk about all the time is that it is definitely one indicator and one metric to economic health, but there's so many other things we have to consider. And that's kind of what we've been looking at. It's in this environment of 2.9% unemployment, where can we move the needle? Where can we find additional levers for economic growth? And so we think about things like wage growth, how many folks are working multiple jobs to make ends meet in Wisconsin, and is our programming conducive to lifting entire industries and driving things like wage growth? Are we seeing quality of life improvements? Are folks underemployed? Are there people that are, again, working multiple jobs? So we look at that metric as an important one, as similar to the labor force participation rate. But we also want to use all the levers available to us to drive those quality of life improvements. And so we want to look at, again, things like wage growth and that growth in comparison to gains in productivity and cost of living increases that we've seen. And so that's something we've been very, very strategic about in our programming and kind of where we've been putting our priorities for this next 4 years.
Well, to that point of underemployment, Scott called in but couldn't stay with us, and he said he works multiple part-time jobs right now because many employers are not hiring full-time positions. However, that does not include insurance, and therefore he can't save for retirement. What is the state doing for the issue of underemployment, considering many people are in this situation?
Good question. And so I've been pretty inspired by the governor's vision. So in the transition and then since taking the job, a lot of the conversations we have are really comprehensive when it comes to workforce and economic development. And the thing we talk about, I think we'll get there and we talk about the workforce shortage also, but investing in economic infrastructure, things like our schools and our roads and our broadband connectivity, as far as being an attractive place to live and what that does for our businesses and our entrepreneurs, but then also investing in things like upskilling. So I'm very excited to be on the Tech College Board as part of my job. We have at DWD youth apprenticeship, registered apprenticeship programs like something called Project Search, which is a way to get youth with disabilities into the workforce. And so we want to make sure that those are quality opportunities. And again, that's exactly, you know, so Tim, I think it was Tim was his name. Those are the experiences that we keep hearing over and over again about, you know, we can't just focus on this one metric as the only bellwether for economic health. There are so many other considerations that we have to take in mind. And so I'm sad to hear that that's the case for him, but it's also reassuring that that's kind of where we're putting our programming focus going forward.
When you look at the economic indicators, what do you do about the people who are out of the workforce, who have fallen out of the workforce and stopped looking for work?
Again, another great question. So this is something that we've talked about a lot with legislators, with private industry, is, you know, there's a huge amount of focus put on the 2.9% of people that aren't working, and how do we get those folks back in the workforce? And that's important work, and we'll keep working on that. And then there are also two other gigantic swaths of Wisconsinites. There are folks that are already working that could be underemployed or underpaid or working multiple part-time jobs. And then there are folks that have left the labor force. And so how do we remove barriers for those folks? And we hear about things like transportation. We hear about the cost of childcare. And so I think the governor uses the phrase quite often, you know, how do we connect the dots? And how do we connect the dots with fellow agencies to remove barriers to employment and encourage some of those folks to come off the sidelines and give them opportunities that are meaningful and that they can, you know, make the dollars and cents make sense where if the cost of childcare is so much, how can we possibly incent a parent to come off the sidelines? And I think the governor's got a plan to double the childcare reimbursement rate. So there are things like that we look at, but that's a huge issue is where we can drive those additional levers for economic growth. It's going to be difficult to get significantly more people out of that pool of 2.9%, but there's a pool of 32% of Wisconsinites that aren't even in the labor force. So that's an area we're putting a lot of focus.
Whose responsibility is it to try to align people with the jobs that are available in the state? Do you look to the private universities, the public universities? Is it companies? You know, how do you make that cog work?
I think that's a really good another example of an area where we look to partner with all of those stakeholders. And I think that's an area we've been pretty successful to this point, and something that I, in my past life as an economic developer, is so important, is drawing those public-private partnerships, and whether it's employers, the tech college system, the four-year university system, state government, those folks have to talk to each other and understand, you know, how we can help each other, where the real bottlenecks and barriers are. And so I'm really encouraged by some of those conversations we've had thus far with those stakeholders, and I think it's going to be something we take in mind going forward.
We're talking with Wisconsin Secretary-Designee of Workforce Development, Caleb Frostman. You can join in. What questions do you have for the state's head of workforce development? Workers, what are your big concerns right now? What are the barriers to employment in Wisconsin that you see? You have a line at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this conversation in just a moment. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's a conversation with Wisconsin's Workforce Development Secretary Designee on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Secretary Caleb Frostman stays with us as we move through labor issues and the goals of the Evers administration on business development across the state. And you can join in 800-642-1234. Business owners, are you having issues finding employees? What would help you? What role should state government play in all of this? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. Let's go straight to the phones now with Mark joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Mark.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So my question is, I work for Microsoft Philanthropies Heals, and we try to support computer science education in schools because we think that that's a shortage in the pipeline. There's not enough young talent that knows how to code. And so I'm wondering how the state might help us engage more schools and then more industry people to help support schools that want to teach programming. We try to engage volunteers that know a little bit of programming to come back into the classrooms and support schools. And I'm wondering if there's a larger part that the state can play in marrying industry to schools.
Thanks for the question, Mark. Secretary?
Sure. So this is interesting. Going back again to my past life in economic development, we're seeing a pretty strong gain of momentum for work-based learning opportunities, whether it's youth apprenticeship. I know in my home area of Northeast Wisconsin, there was the IT Alliance, which was put together by the Bay Area Workforce Development Board. But people are seeing really strong returns in terms of connecting students with employers kind of early and often, making that connection early. So, and I'm sure we'll get there also. And this worker shortage kind of across industries, I think people really want to make sure that students understand that there are challenging, fulfilling living wage jobs in Wisconsin and that they can stick around after school to fill those jobs. And, you know, heaven forbid they leave, they can certainly come back. And so I think we're going to be very, very strong proponents of continuing putting emphasis on work-based learning opportunities and looking for where we can see the highest return on investment. And based on, you know, kind of what we see, I certainly anticipate IT and coding being a huge part of that based on where we see, you know, again, looking at the stats in terms of where starting wages are and where can we have our greatest impact on economic growth. I think IT and those kind of things will be a big part of that conversation going forward.
Let's go to Tom now, joining us from Burlington. Hi, Tom.
Can you address the connection between marijuana testing in urine and the workforce in California? They've stopped testing people. We're losing a lot of good workers because of this crazy marijuana law that's been just absolutely outdated.
So Tom's saying we're losing workers due to the drug tests.
It's interesting. So and going back to what we discussed earlier in terms of the a lot of the emphasis that gets put on the 2.9% of folks who are looking for work and not finding it, you know, a lot of private employers will, you know, lament some of the soft skills that people are lacking, like punctuality, reliability, or the ability to pass a drug test. And so I do think looking at, you know, other states that have passed, you know, legalizing recreational marijuana, you know, we could certainly learn from other states that have implemented best practices when it comes to drug testing. And there are people in Wisconsin now who manage chronic pain with, you know, prescription opioids, and they do it as prescribed, but some of those show up on drug tests as well. And so we can, I think, learn from best practices within Wisconsin as well as other states that have either passed legalizing recreational marijuana, those kind of things to address that issue.
We've seen Wisconsin-based companies go bankrupt over the last couple of years. Bonton, high profile. Now thousands of Shopko employees are losing their jobs as the company folds. How is the Department of Workforce Development assisting these employees transition to what comes next?
So we send our rapid response team up to those areas almost immediately. And so we've got folks that help, you know, because some of these people have been in these roles for 15, 20, 25, 30 years. And so it's really challenging to make that transition from, even if it's a similar industry, to go from one employer to another. And so we want to be as helpful as possible. So we work with our area workforce development boards and their rapid response teams to get to those companies and talk to those employees, help them with, you know, sometimes drafting a resume for the first time in 20 years, helping them hone their interview skills, and also helping them kind of see what's out there as far as similar work from a skill set perspective and also from a compensation perspective. So we've been very, very busy this year with both Bonton and Shopko closures.
Wisconsin has a board dedicated to maximizing business potential in the state, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. How are you working with WEDC?
So we work with them on a couple different initiatives, so Foxconn being one of them, but then also when it comes to the big picture discussion of talent attraction, there's been some pretty strong interest, I think, from you know, DWD being part of those conversations, as well as the Department of Tourism, and then some private organizations. I think if we can be part of that discussion, whether it's for our veterans, whether it's for UW alumni, whether it's for millennials, whether it's for anyone coming back to Wisconsin or trying to get them to stay, we work closely with them, and we've been working with them on something called the Military Spouse Economic Empowerment Zone. So we have a pretty good relationship there. I've known Deputy Secretary Braun and Secretary Hogan for a long time in a past life, so we've had a pretty good relationship there thus far.
So communication lines are open, working on the same page, regardless of the lame duck session, you know, really gave the governor less influence over WEDC, and you know, how do you reconcile that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I think everyone's trying to do the best they can with you know, what all that's gone on in the last 4 months. It's been kind of a wild 4 months as far as the lame duck session in December and kind of what's happened since. But I think, you know, the folks that we've been working with over there and the folks at DVD want to see, you know, more Wisconsinites be employed. They want to see Wisconsinites have better jobs. They want to see Wisconsin businesses find the employees they need. And so it's been nice, you know, on a bipartisan basis with fellow agencies, with legislators. Our goals are so bipartisan in nature that we can generally find common ground on what it is we want to get accomplished, maybe some different ideas on how to get there. But it's been pretty productive thus far.
Let's go to Margaret now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Margaret.
Hello, Mr. Secretary. Hi. When I was growing up, everybody took driver's ed, and it was paid for by the schools. And today, I see so many young people driving around without licenses, losing licenses, making it unsafe on the roads, can't get to work because they don't have cars, because the transportation system isn't getting them there. In terms of connecting the dots, couldn't DOT and workforce development and the schools get together and pay for low-income people to take driver's ed? It's like $400 a kid. And when you're low-income, that's not going to be your priority.
What do we know about transportation?
That it's a huge barrier for the folks in that 2.9%, and even the folks that are already working. You know, sometimes it's a barrier to getting a better job. And it's interesting. It's sometimes access to a car, or access to driver's ed, or affordability of driver's ed in rural areas. And then there are places like in you know, southeast Wisconsin, where if you're taking public transportation and you cross a county line, the bus stops right there. So this is a definitely a critical issue as far as a barrier to employment or a barrier to better employment for young people, for rural folks, for urban folks, for elderly people, for everyone on the spectrum, and not to mention the condition of our roads when it comes to you know, getting products in and tourists in and supplies out and those kind of things. This is a big issue we hear a lot about all across the state.
Let's talk minimum wage here for a moment. Wisconsin's minimum wage is $7.25 an hour, but under the governor's proposed budget would increase gradually over the next couple of years. Republicans say there could be unintended consequences and businesses could be hurt by raising the wage. Where do you fall on this?
So we've been really, I think it's really important to note that the governor in the transition and afterwards, you know, took input from a really diverse set of stakeholders, and that included the business community. And so what you see in this proposal to go from $7.25 and then raising it an hour per hour, or $1 per hour in year one, and then 75 cents per hour in years two, three, and four is a really modest, incremental, yet meaningful increase for those folks making minimum wage. And so it's an incremental approach that our businesses can adjust to and absorb over time, while we also simultaneously put together this task force to try to find a way to a more livable living wage. This is a really modest, measured incremental approach that will change the quality of people's lives. And if it's interesting, if you look, someone making $7.25 an hour working full time makes just over $15,000 a year. So if you have a child making that, you're below the federal poverty rate. So right now in Wisconsin, we have a law that says you can pay someone 40 hours a week that might have a child, and that wage can keep them below the federal poverty, which is kind of mind-blowing. And so this is meaningful increases for those folks making $7.25 an hour and very modest and measured for the businesses that can absorb these costs over time.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Caleb Frostman is the secretary designee of the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. Just ahead, a Milwaukee area company is developing a painkiller that it says will be a non-addictive alternative to prescription opioids. We'll take a look at the research behind the drug and the safety of opioid alternatives. That's coming up here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.